So welcome. Welcome, everyone. So this is my second talk on metta. The first talk I talked about the practice of metta and how what we are attempting to do is to really break down some of the barriers that separate us from others. We start separating ourselves out from others very early on as we learn our own traits and distinctions and bear judgment upon those who from either our delight or bitterness don't own or don't measure up to our particular standards. And that continues throughout our adult life, and we find ourselves at this age, whatever age we are listening to this, often very much judgmental, very opinionated about each and every person and every expression from that person. We have some sense of comment about. And so we need to reverse that process, and the form and expression of metta is an attempt to do just that. It attempts through a series of objects of different classifications of people to break down the opinions we have of them by looking at something that is commonly shared by us all and thereby removing the boundaries that separate us. And it's a beautiful practice to do, and I hope some of you who find yourself strongly judgmental and opinionated use it. But it's in itself, it's not sufficient to eliminate opinions, at least for most people. We have to do deep inward work to find out why it is that we want to have opinions, what we value and get from opinions. Why do we maintain our opinions? It's obvious that they separate. It's obvious that they distance us from each other. But why do we persist in having them? What is it that we how is it that we value opinions enough to keep them moving, keep ourselves engaged with them? And it's a profound inquiry to undertake. The reason that I form opinions, why is it that I do that? Just ask yourself from time to time how a judgment serves you. And I think you'll find that it does serve you. We wouldn't do it if it were just painful. We do it because it helps us in our own distinguishment, in our own distinction. And that says an awful lot about how we work the world at large, in every direction, in every way, is for and to our advantage. So that as this practice of metta begins to pan out further and further, and boundaries are beginning to be eliminated, and our opinions are beginning to be investigated and looked and dropped because of the tension that is created within them, no longer is substantial enough to, or the value we receive from them, the distinction we get from them, begins to pale by the pain that we begin to note we have when we use them, we begin to release the need to have opinions. And so what that does is it establishes or we start releasing the boundaries that we have set up in the world at large. First with people, because they're the most opinionated. We have the most opinionations about others and ourselves, the most about ourselves, but others. And then as that occurs, there's a transformation of perception that follows the release of the boundaries. And we begin to see life rather than individual human expressions. Believe me, it's a quite an endeavor just to get to the point when I can see humanity as humanity rather than the appearances that I judge through that human perception. But it keeps moving if we are tenacious and inclined. And suddenly we find a resonance not just with humanity, but with all of life, with a sense of all beings. And the expression that that sentient being takes is kind of irrelevant, really, because our heart begins to move not in accordance with the similarities we have with it, but the fact that it's alive, the aliveness itself. And now we're coming really to the root of what love is when we start talking about aliveness itself. And of course, as I was mentioning, the next expression is that the mind, although still back there translating and depicting and classifying, comes to a point where it no longer expresses itself in shape and appearance, so that it begins to see consciousness as alive in all directions, in all places, at all times. It doesn't say, this is animate and this is inanimate, this deserves my love and this doesn't. Even that barrier is crossed, so that aliveness itself is merged. Now, somewhere along the line here, as we become more, with our judgments become quieter, and we become less noisy in all the opinions we hold and all the judgments we have, there can be a rupture in the veil of how we see the world. And we can catch a glimpse of a world that is truly love-based, that is at the epicenter is love, not an individual expression of love, not an individuated love, but love for its own sake. And that glimpse, we could call awakening, can be, it's very startling to many of us, but it's also can be very disconcerting because it shakes our world. Now, it also happens that people of long-standing inclination and practice can not have that glimpse. But it doesn't matter, because just in their perseverance, in their continuation of moving in the direction of releasing the boundaries that separate them, there's a change of perception that occurs all along the way. And we may not notice it in a radical sense, but if I took you back to where you started and showed you 10 years ago, you would say, my God, why did my mind ever look like that? Well, it looked like that because it thought like that, because those were the assumptions that it held. 10 years later, it doesn't hold that, and it sees the world very differently. Although you can't see a particular time, it's like watching a child grow, you can't see a particular time when you no longer believed in that particular aspect of life, but it's there. And many people arrive at the orientation of awakening without actually, or some people do, without actually having that rupture in the perceptual shift occur as dramatically as others. So whether it happens to you in a graduated way or whether it happens to you in an abrupt way, doesn't really matter. It's happening to all of us. It can't help but happen to you, because that is the direction that Buddhism takes. It takes the direction of quietude. It takes the direction of less boundary formation. It takes the direction of interconnectedness, of being able to feel the world in a different way than how your eyes betray it. In that sense of heart, that sense of an inward expression of the world, even though my eyes still get fixed upon individuated differences, my mind doesn't back that perception up with a lot of story or a lot of noise or a lot of argument or resistance. It just sees it and releases it very quickly. And the heart begins to feel itself more stimulated, more powerfully manifested. And that's really where the shift occurs. That's really where the transition occurs. It occurs in this organ, the heart organ, not the mind, not the mind's organ. The mind does what it does and will do it what it does for a long period of time. But if it happens abruptly, and I'd just like to talk for a minute about that, because I know sometimes it does happen that way. People have told me in interviews, etc. And there can be a disenchantment that occurs. That, like, all of a sudden, this wonder opened, and then now I'm back to my old perceptions of life. And we can get lost in thinking that, the heaven was pulled out from under us. And what good is life now? You know, I've seen it, and it's not accessible to me, or we can feel that way. We can feel that even if it were, what I'm doing now in my everyday mundane life feels very typical, normal, and very sort of just mundane, just not living up to the inspiration of that glimpse. And this is a partial, many of us have that. I would even say most people after a glimpse has that impact upon them, but it's not the complete story, you see. The complete story is that love comes back in. The disenchantment feels cut off from, feels distant to. But with patience and a continual willingness to surrender our boundaries, the heart gets re-engaged, doesn't get caught in the disenchantment. And what comes forth in that re-engagement is a sense of universal love. However life is perceived, in whatever modality, in whatever way, self and other, or in commonality to all, love becomes the way, the motivation, the reason for the continuance. And the disenchantment can't sustain itself. It was a momentary fluctuation of an opinion, but love, when it comes back out, when it reemerges, completes the circle. And it doesn't matter whether that glimpse is able to be sustained, because even without that, there is the knowledge or the feeling that it's there, that it once perceived, always known, and that the medium through which it all is held is love. And so then one works to bring forth greater and greater access to that love. And that allows greater space in oneself, and with that greater space comes less identification with thought and quietude, deeper sense of quietude. There's also an aspect of it that is a tremendous healing quality. Awakening, or the glimpse, doesn't really create much healing. In fact, we're often left pretty much in the ragged condition that we were prior to that glimpse, with the old reaction still very much present, and often very full of our ideology and thought content. The healing component really comes from the love. And the love is the way that we are within whatever perceptions we hold. For instance, let me just speak for a moment about the deep healing involved with emotions, often very reactive emotions, the difficult emotions. Now, if you think of what an emotion is like for you, a difficult emotion, some reactivity of mine, anger or fear or mistrust or irritation, impatience, you can feel that that emotion is a kind of resistance. It holds itself in a kind of resistance to life. And it's a sense that, you know, whatever is happening shouldn't be happening. And I'm angry that it is. So there's a protest that's going on, and that's the amplitude or the volatility of the emotion that's being carried. But if you look at what is actually happening in that moment, that spike emotion of a resistance, often you'll find that something that was very important to you is blocked. Something that was very meaningful to you was kept from you. And that's the reason the resistance is there. This shouldn't be happening, is the comment, mental comment, but followed by a volatile emotional reaction. Now, the fact that there's something that we cared about that is being held from us, we could say is the definition of grief. And it's important to see that many of the volatile emotions we have really have their basis in grief. And having been deprived of something, certainly anger. And that if we reorient ourselves to the sense of loss we have for not having what we wanted, rather than the tantrum we're having around that not having, then we can begin to feel the effects of the love that's involved in the healing ourselves to that rift that just occurred. And so when there is an emotional spike and an anger and a tantrum that many of us, even to this day, express, take a moment here and see if it's related to grief, something that you cared about didn't occur. And if you want an immediate example, you could use a Super Bowl. Okay, so now, under that sense of grief, that sense of something missing, now it's not anger at the loss so much as the agony of being separated from something you love, which is grief, right? But there is a renewal that's there for people who are willing to release the context out of which that loss occurred and allow love to flood in. Because now there can be love that resurges back in, even though there is still something missing that you wish had been there. And that resurgence of love that comes back confirms the perfection, you might say, of what is occurring, including the loss of what didn't happen. Did people follow that? You see, it's all in our willingness to base ourselves in the love rather than in the reactivity, into the statement of the mind's love. Mind's love is around formation. This form didn't occur, didn't happen at the right time, the right place, or it didn't happen at all. And therefore, that form I miss. And when there is a form that's missed, because all forms will be missed at some point in your life, you know that, because all forms are temporary, are just expressions of appearances that are in constant disarray. And so at a certain point, if we infuse this much investment in a form that is sure to leave us, we will feel the grief associated with that investment. So that's mental love. That's love from an idea, which is how formations occur. But then there is formless love, that regardless of the presence or absence of form, loves anyway. It isn't dependent upon form for this sense of love. And it is that is the unconditioned love. And it is that the metta practice is meant to access. We have to move through form. We have to see what we're doing to create the individual differences, the distinctions, the reasons that we perceive in the individuated way that we do. And as we study and investigate how it is that we lose ourselves time and time again within our relationship to other expressions of form, we start relaxing the need to invest in form. And what comes into the field of awareness is the formless love, the unconventional love, the unconditioned love. Now, I'd like to give you little ways and hints towards accessing that. And metta is a good one, but don't get stuck in metta as a way to sort of clean yourself up. It's really not about cleaning yourself up, it's cleaning yourself out. It's removing yourself from the picture, really. Because you, each of us, are also formed through our opinions. It's not just the other person. They aren't the ones that hold all of our opinions. Look at yourself from time to time and see how much opinionation there is about you and I. And we sustain ourselves through our opinions. So if we're going to let go of opinions of others, we have to let go of opinions of ourselves. We have to be willing to move into a world that is opinionless. And that requires a different level of commitment, not just one to kind of clean up our consciousness so I don't have as many judgments as I used to have, but this is a different level of encouragement, of moving ourselves forward. And this is really where healing comes in. Because when we start looking at ourselves, we see a mess. I mean, I do, don't you? Nobody wants to admit to the mess, so we sit up straight, right? And now everybody that looks at us says, wow, a Buddha. And inside we say, no, a mess. Right? So we have to clean up that mess. We just don't beautify it for appearance sake. That's losing our way in the Dharma. We have to go into this stuff and clean it up. And how do we clean it up? We clean it up through love. We clean it up through, I mean, it's not this romantic thing. People have a false idea of what unconditional love is. It's not sort of the tinge of sweetness and romanticism that we offer it. It's not. It's just, it's clear. It's clean. It's just a full embrace of life. And many of the Brahma Viharas, those abodes of Brahma, are just different aspects of love when love faces different aspects of life. When love faces pain, compassion arises. When love faces someone's success, joy arises in the other person's success, or with the other person's success. When love sees without reactivity and story, which is the nature of love, we call that equanimity. Okay? And when it's just sitting, embracing life for the sense of interconnectedness that life is, then it's just warm-heartedness. It's kindness. It moves in accordance with the perception, the way it holds the world. And may I invite us all to move in accordance with that. Even prior to the perceptual shift, we need to move our actions forward as if it were true and I'm just not seeing it, right? Like a fog bank. We know our car's out there, I'm going to walk towards it. I can't see it, but I know it's there. And so too, we have to move in accordance. We have to start walking towards this, inclining ourselves towards it, even if there's a fog bank of messiness that's clouding a clear perception of where it's located or its exact location. And I was listening to somebody's Dharma talk, so this isn't my statement, but I thought it was a good one. And the person said, it's a good way to start moving in that direction is accept this moment as if you had chosen it. Accept this moment as if you had chosen it. I really like that. Not that you chose it, not that you created it. That's it's a little too New Agey. There's a tremendous truth to the fact that the world comes into appearance dependent upon many different factors. But the fact that as if I had chosen it. Now, if you relate to this moment as if, now you can become in alignment to the present moment without the implications that I did this to myself, which is where we get confused and mixed up. So as if I had chosen it. Now, as if I had chosen it, suddenly, now I'm settled, you see? And that settledness allows less anger, allows less protest, less resistance, less upsetness about the conditions that we will all face. That is the inroad. That is how love begins to appear, is by reducing the amount of resistance we have to being where we are through all the sense stores and our resistances and objections to whatever it is that's coming in. So use that, if that's helpful to you. So I want to move now to a new theme, a different theme, which is tied to your homework, which I thought was an important theme to bring into love, and that is love and belonging. You know, as I meet with people over the years, there is a deep, almost soulful search for our true location in life. Where do we belong? You know, we try to find it everywhere. We try to find it in our name. We try to find it in our image. We try to find it in our tribe. You know, those that are Seattleites versus those that are in Boston. We try to find it in our gender. We try to find it in our ethnicity. We try to find it everywhere. We try to find a sense of belonging, somewhere I can rest authentically and claim this to be my place. And I find that there's a subtle form of restlessness to people who have not found their true belonging. And that love cannot settle unless we have settled, unless we know our place on earth. Love will not settle with us. It requires that from us. It cannot form itself. It cannot locate itself in someone who's in movement mentally, in agitation, in restlessness. It's there, it's just being overseen, it's being overlooked. So finding our sense of belonging is extremely important. Now, how do you find your sense of belonging? Because how does the meditation, how does the practice allow us to come to a sense of belonging? See? Usually we try to find it mentally. We try to find it through some sense of inward contentment that is, we're hoping to be close at hand. Perhaps we try to find it through the relaxation response of just deeply settling into ourselves. But in the back there somewhere, not too far behind us, is a gnawing sense that we're out of place. That we should be moving slightly to the left or right. And it's because of how we have lived under the opinionation of other people, and we have felt the tensions of our own life, because we, as well as other people, are constantly in tension with where other people are in relationship to our life, or where we are in relationship to other people's life. It never quite fits in. It never quite settles down to a place where I can relax and say, it is here. This is where I truly belong. Because mostly we, of course, think ourselves out of our position. We look into a person's eyes and wonder what they want from us that we're not offering. And then we try to make that person content in their vision of us by manipulating ourselves to fit their expectation. And of course, that isn't belonging. And at some point, you begin to sense that there's something authentic in us that we have bypassed. And as we began to ferret out what is that authentic quality, that core that's in us, and is there some sense that that core could lead us to a sense of belonging in life, we find ourselves getting quieter once more. Because we realize that the sense of belonging and the sense of authenticity really isn't in all the ideas I've had about you, and certainly not all the ideas I have about myself. That those ideas are as whimsical and full of story and narrative, and that I'll never satisfy the narrative so that it comes to a complete and timely ending. And so that I have to begin to do this on my own. I have to find some sense of myself that is true, despite what the world is telling me I need to do, or should be, or who I am, and also my own manufactured ideas of my own sense of relationship. And here again, the practice leads us in that direction. We will find our belonging within silence. The last place we look. We've turned over all the other stones. The last stone we would ever turn over, we wouldn't even want to approach that stone, is the stone of stillness. What does that stone hold for me? It seems to hold some sense of amorphous, cloud-shaped confusion. That doesn't give me any distinction. But yet, the more I have tried to find my distinction, the less I feel like I belong. And so because of the utter futility of the search of trying to find my distinction, my uniqueness, my sense of a place on this earth, through my judgments or your judgments of me, I have ceased in the movement of that now. And I call then on something that I sense can give me a more primal direction towards that truth. I call upon love. I don't know what I am. I'm confused. I'm fully mixed up in here. Let me just sit with this. Not invest in whatever is my mind is saying as the truth of myself, but let me sit with all of this and see if something doesn't settle out that gives me a truer north, a clearer depiction, an exact coordinate. And what's interesting is the less distinctions we have, the clearer those coordinates are. The less we can pinpoint the exact location we are in terms of our ideas and expressions and interactions, the more universal our heart is, the clearer our position in life is. It's just the opposite of the way I have tried to find myself. And so I want to give you an exercise. Right? I want to give you an exercise. When you get out of bed in the morning, confirm your belonging by saying, I have arrived. One step out of the bed, I have arrived. Second step, this is where I belong. And then move through the day with that confidence, with each step. In fact, I'm teaching walking meditation now with walking so that the first step, this is my home. I have arrived. This is my home. I have arrived. That is a technique used by Thich Nhat Hanh, which I have brought into my actual instructions, because I feel that we can do walking meditation forever and miss what's authentically there. I don't know what we're doing walking meditation, but we miss the fact that we have an orientation, that we have a location, that we have complete composure. Love and belonging. A friend of mine who is a spiritual teacher got a call from a very anxious, frenetic person who was screaming and crying and just in an uproar late at night, like 2:00 in the morning. And this is the time, this is before cell phones. And she was just listening to the person on the phone, and she said to the person on the phone, she said, listen, would you put me in touch with the person who looked up my name and dialed the number? I want to speak to them, not the person who's speaking now. Okay. Somebody had to be collected enough to do all the background work, to make the dial, to call the number, and then she lost her sense of location. Right? That sense of location, that sense is with us. We just don't give it much credence. We would rather be the volatile, screaming, out of control person. That somehow highlights us in a way that shows us we really need your support. We really need your attention. What you really need is your own attention. What you really need is your own support. And we can find that center in us. We can find that located point, that GPS in us. If we take the time and we're quiet enough. I remember when I was very young, like high school, and I got drunk. And I was really pretty drunk. And I went into the bathroom and I looked in the mirror and I looked in there and I said, there's somebody in there, there's some part of that, of me, that's looking in that mirror that's not drunk. And I'm going to try to get that part drunk. And I couldn't do it. There was always somebody who knew I was drunk. And I couldn't get the knower drunk. Right? Now all of us have that. We'd love to do without it. We'd love to exercise it sometimes. Not act with an ER, that's an OR. Exorcise. Right? We have that in us, the sanity, the stability, the authenticity, the knowing. And it's there if we just give it credence, if we just give it enough investment. That's also the heart, the expression of our heart. That's also, if we moved into that, would be the quiet, the stillness, the located center the authentic place but to abide in action and start moving ourselves into this and through this so that we begin to know it in action. We begin to really look for that little voice that says, I'm not drunk, although the body is inebriated, I'm not drunk. That place, that point. And to flesh it out. To start moving with that, to start living from there. And the surest way to know that we are living from there is that there's a greater sensitivity to the world. The surest way to know that you are living free of your opinions and your judgments is that the world begins to rub up against us with texture, that we feel it. We feel the textures of it, emotional textures, perceptual textures. So we're laying right flat on it. We're picking up the rug imprints on our skin. And it's not a weak sensitivity. It's sensitivity with strength. It's a sensitivity that can say no as easily as it can say yes. It's a sensitivity with great space and great wonder. It's not giving away our boundaries. It's not the loss of our own self-caring. We measure our self-caring in equal measure to the needs of the world. Sometimes we move out, sometimes we don't. Sometimes we arrest that movement because we need to replenish ourselves. It's not just one-sided. It's not always leaning away from ourselves into others. We are an equal part of consciousness. We are them. And love eventually moves beyond that, even into fear, which seems like the opposite of love. But love surrounds fear, so it's not the opposite. And the way you know that fear is operating is that it's in movement. Fear is always in movement. It's either in physical movement, I'm getting out of here, I'm fleeing. It's in mental movement by trying to figure out alternatives and think of what is about to occur and all of that. And love is not in movement. And that's why it always wins out, because what's in movement cannot sustain itself when there is nothing agitating it towards greater movement. And so stillness always wins out, regardless of the degree of movement, to be still even in fear. It's not a judgment on fear, it's just not adding any more energy to fear. And so it becomes quiet. Thank you. Can we just sit for a minute or two? Okay, so if there's any questions or comments, I'd be happy to respond to them if I can.
you talked a little bit about belonging with love, this the ability to make difficult decisions, understanding, you know, there's so much story attached to all the options. Talk a little bit more about that.
The ability to make difficult decisions and the sense of belonging. How do you make difficult decisions, and how are making those difficult decisions connected with that sense of belonging, that sense of rootedness? I remember a very important decision. It seemed important at the time. I was just coming out from being a monk, and I couldn't figure out whether I needed to live with people or live alone. And I could certainly see the advantages to both. And I felt the storylines and the pressures of both, financial pressures, etc. And I thought, okay, I'm just not going to make this decision based upon an emotional response to what's occurring. I'm going to settle myself out and see if there's a deeper sense of belonging within one of those two dispositions, either living alone or where would I feel most readily most centered. And by that I don't mean you could always say, well, obviously living alone. No, not obviously living alone. Because when you're looking at the nature of belonging, you're looking at growth, really. Where are you thriving? Where are you most alive? Where we're most alive is when we're growing. And that doesn't necessarily mean when we're separated and isolated from others. It can often mean when we're with others. So you have to get a sense of what belonging means. Belonging is not only an exact location of body, although sometimes that's all we have, and that's the most important thing. But it's where we're the richest, where we're within our inward wealth, where it's the wealthiest, where we're the wealthiest. And I don't mean that in any financial sense. I mean that in terms of richness of spirit. You know you belong. This is exactly where I need to be, some of us would say. And I found a decision coming out of that, not based upon the conditioned past of where I would have liked to have been, but rather that where what was the most rich response I needed to make. Now, decisions come from clarity, not from opinions. We think that if I have more opinions about what's going on here, then I'll make a clearer decision. Sometimes it's true, you need the background information. But then we also need to be quiet and let discernment, let the clarity of quietude with all of the background information there, if we need it, begin to say yes or no. And there's never a right or wrong. You just say yes, I'm doing this. And it's oftentimes an intuitive discernment, even more than the logic of the information we hold. There's a sense of the direction I need to take. And the majority of times, that sense of where I need to take is the correct one. So you can hold all the information. You can do everything right and still make the wrong decision. And I see it a lot. Look at the last play of the ball game. Or you can just be quiet in yourself. Okay, no, this isn't right. This isn't going. And move forward with that. And even if you move forward and then you fall on your face, you will have advanced one step and one body length. So that mistakes actually feed back into the quality of discernment. In fact, you should relish mistakes. If you just went straight line from birth to death, what kind of a life would that be? You're going to bloody yourself a little bit. You're going to get muddy. You know, you got to step on people's toes and they step on yours. That's how the whole thing unfolds. So there isn't a right or wrong direction. It's whether you're learning through it all, whether we are actually frozen in protest or whether we're saying, wow, that was stupid. I mean, what's going on there? Now that I need to, and then we move forward. It's the moving that's important. And we move best through the protest, not from the absence of it. The conflicts, the irritations, the annoyances, the difficulties. That's how we learn. So not to be afraid of those or try to bypass those in the decision we're making. But where is the richest? What's the richest expression and posture? Where is this? Any other questions? Yes. So how do we hold other people's projections? Well, I mean, you can't imagine the projections that being a teacher that come to you, okay? So, I mean, the idealization, the romanticism of it, you know, the just where a person goes, especially early on, not so much with maturity, but early on people really think that the practice, you know, takes you otherworldly, makes you otherworldly. So there's a tremendous amount of, I just have never felt them, because I don't believe that in myself. I mean, even if they say it to me, thank you, I appreciate that, that just isn't correct, but that's, I don't foster or feed them because that's not how I evaluate myself. So if you don't evaluate yourself according to the projections that come, they just slough off, they don't land. They really don't land. If you have a tendency or a need towards what other people are saying, to be what other people are saying, which is mutual exploitation, because you're not that, but you're pretending to be that, so they're leaning into that pretension and continued projection, and you're now caught in a vicious circle of inauthenticity, then we need to pull ourselves out of this thing and say, where is this taking me? You see, especially in a teaching role, especially in any profession, like a doctor. Doctors get enormous projection. Heal me, you know, it's like that. I found that many of them assume that projection and live within that kind of, within that frame of reference. Many don't. You know, I think it has to do with what we need for ourselves and the pain we hold of ourselves, and why we assume other people's projection is to decrease the pain of our own sense of unworthiness. So unless we have done adequate work so that we aren't hurting as much inwardly, we're going to be wanting people to love us because there's a dearth of that in ourselves. Right? It's always that. There are some teachers who want their students to like them. Most of us want people to like us. But I think that's a casualty. I think there's a real casualty to that. Because I have to be able, a teacher has to be able to say yes or no. It has to be able to tell you what he or she sees. And many times that's not very likable. That doesn't increase our bonding. So there has to be enough belonging in oneself that you aren't dependent upon someone liking you in order to belong. No. Yes. So let us look at our own neediness. Where is it? What is it? Where do we still need the world to nurture our sense of belonging? Because that's where we're ripe for being inauthentic.
Just what you said about how you can't be judgmental and critical and belong at the same time. I just went through this period at work where the whole staff is pretty stressed out and hemorrhaging from the clinic, basically. And people were getting really negative, including myself. And I felt, even though we were all doing the same thing every day, being negative together, basically, I felt really disconnected. And as I'm trying to make a practice of not being so negative at work, even when I'm surrounded by people who are, I feel like I belong more there, even by not participating in that. And it's really interesting. It's mm-hmm. almost like, well, I'm belonging to a place that I want to nurture.
Yes, beautiful. She's at work and there's a highly negative charged feeling at work, and she sees that she could have the tendency to go and continue that sense of negativity, or she can create a more uplift environment, and chooses to do the latter, and so doing feels more like she belongs within that group than she did when it was just, you know, it's very interesting where we get our sense of belonging. If you're at a water cooler in the office and everybody's starting to talk about, you know, their boss in a judgmental way, and that spiral down, and you can feel that everybody wants you to concede their opinion and agree with it, and the whole thing starts spiraling down. You can feel in your heart that something's amiss when you do that. You go, oh God, you know, this is just something, it just feels unwholesome, for lack of a better word. And, you know, because that's, you're not belonging there. You don't belong in that. That you have grown out of the need for judgment to support your life at that point. And so for your willingness to uplift, to raise the bar, of the, really allows you to have a purpose and a meaning within that that is not just more of the same, right? So you're getting, likely, you're getting a sense of yourself not as a product of the negativity, but as another option, as a different possibility, right? Because that's the uplift. And even if you have to stand alone, you can still feel your sense of self-resolve and your sense of self and in the authenticity within that, right? Okay, all. Thank you. Thank you.